and welcome to episode 7 of Popcorn and Prosecco, a full 30 minutes of nonstop movie talk. This week, we're going to cover The Raid 2, Cheap Thrills, and Noah. I'm Perry Nemiroff, and here are my co-hosts, Angie Han and Christy Prochko.
Hi.
Hey.
All right, Christy, you want to kick it off with The Raid 2?
Yeah, so The Raid 2 is a direct sequel from The Raid Redemption, which is the Gareth Evans movie that made everybody go bonkers a couple years ago. This one picks up with Rama, the good guy from the first one, and he dives into a new adventure where instead of fighting in a building where everyone's trying to kill him, he goes undercover into an organized crime syndicate and tries to suss out who in it is, like the corrupt cops involved in it. But the main focus of the movie is actually another character, effectively called Uko, who is the son of the crime lord that befriends Rama. Uko wants to be in charge. He wants his dad to give him more responsibility, but his dad is not giving up the reins just yet, so Uko decides to form a coup. And that's kind of, these two things make up the main plot of the movie, which even though I just told you like pretty succinctly that that's the plot, it takes up a lot of the movie. I feel like that's just important to lay out, because with The Raid, it was like, it was basically like a video game, where it was like, now we defeat this level, now this level, now this level, now boss level, and the plot was like really paper thin, but that was fine, because it was a lot of action. This is a lot more plot.
Yeah, and that was really the problem with it, is it's 50 minutes longer than The Raid, and most of that extra 50 minutes is taken up by this plot, which... I have nothing against a good plot line. Like, I love movies with great plot lines, but this wasn't a great plot line. Like, it's a very cliched gangster drama that has, you know, delusions of grandeur. Like, it thinks it's a new Godfather. It's not. It's a really cliched plot line with really cliched characters, and I just found myself being like, oh my god, get to the action. I'm here
get
to watch
Hammer Girl.
Because the action is just as good as it was in the last one. It's pretty great. So that hasn't changed. It's
the
just
running
that.
Time, you know, is the reason that I didn't end up seeing it. I got a lot of invites and I kept committing to going, and, you know, I just had a lot on my plate, and the screening would come and I'd be like, shit, 2.5 hours plus, you know, a 15-minute commute each way. I'm going to see it another time.
15-minute commute? You would. I yeah. got there, and it was a day where I was actually really, like, I was in the throes of a bad cold. And I was just like, I got to the theater and I was like, I wonder what the running time is. And I was like, oh, fuck. Like, I was like, I regret everything in my life that led me to this decision. You know, I'm exaggerating. It was actually, it was a
feels long.
It's, you know, it feels a little long. I think maybe I'm being a little bit critical, but, you know, the stuff that worked in the first movie still works well, like, which is mainly the action, which is as great as ever, and because there's all these other characters that he brings in, it's different kinds of action, like you mentioned Hammer Girl, whose whole thing is she fights with a couple of hammers, and she is a badass. Mm-hmm. And she clearly, but the other thing is, there's all these weird, it almost felt like it was like a season of a drama condensed into 2.5 hours, because they kind of hint at all these other weird subplots that then don't go anywhere.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, like Hammer Girl, they kind of sort of hint that she has
like her and her brother, and they have a black backstory that's alluded to but never fleshed out.
It's like barely alluded to. It's there just enough that you know that the filmmaker like had something in mind, but they never explain what it is.
Yeah, and it's actually kind of frustrating, because for as much time, well, as much energy is put into setting up Hammer Girl, like, I feel like she's more iconic than any of the killers or fighters we've seen Gareth Evans set up so far. But it doesn't matter. There's no I mean, she doesn't really have a lot to do in the plot, you know? She's a couple of fight scenes, and that's it. It's not interesting, ultimately. And, like, they bring back the guy who played Mad Dog in the first movie to play a killer in this movie. He's the one with the beard in this. And I thought that was really cool.
A completely unrelated character.
Yeah. And he's another person that gets, like, this backstory that could have been its own movie, and honestly, I would have watched that movie. He was a really interesting character, because in the first movie, he's just scary and Mad Dog, and in this one, he has this really interesting thing where he's a killer, but he has a family, and he does it for them because he's not a smart man, but he's good at killing people, and it's a really interesting plot line, but it's one that gets condensed into just this kind of two-scene narrative in the movie, and then, like, oh, some action scenes. Like, it just feels like Gareth Evans was like, I have my moment, everyone's paying attention, I'm going to do everything I ever thought about doing in one movie. And it's just too much. And it's like, I complained in my review that it doesn't really feel like a sequel, because four people from the first movie show up in the first 10 minutes, and by the end of that 10 minutes, only one of them is part of the plot anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I get that it's probably an easier movie to market if you market it as a sequel, especially because, you know, it's a foreign film. It's not the kind of movie, you know, by a director that isn't... People like him, but he's not famous
known.
Or anything. The actors don't name actors.
Who Gareth Evans is.
Dewey keeps meowing, and that's why the camera keeps cutting to me, if anyone's wondering.
No, that's a really adorable reason. I love it. Anyway, but I get why. I guess I understand to some extent why they thought that it'd be better to market it as a sequel, but the plot line of The Raid 2 has literally nothing to do with the plot line of The Raid 1. It's a completely separate drama. The only real overlap is that the main character has the same name and is played by the same person.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's not really a character.
They don't continue his arc from the first film, though.
No, not really. Like, you don't need to know anything that happened to him in the first movie to understand what's going on in this movie at all.
Exactly. It's just and another adventure with Rama. And, like, I like the lead actor. But, again, it's so not even about him. It's not his movie. It's, like, weirdly Uko's movie. I don't know if I'm saying his name right, so excuse me, but... And who cares about that guy? He's whiny, and I say that as I, like, whine. But he's whiny, and he's just like, I want to be in charge. It's like, who cares? He's not a compelling protagonist, and he ultimately is the protagonist of this movie, which is not exciting. The action scenes are amazing, but, like, the thing is, you know, with the internet the way it is, someone's going to do a supercut where they cut out a bunch of these scenes, and I'd rather watch that movie. And I know that sounds really mean. It's just too much stuff. It's too bloated. Like, The Raid Redemption was a lean, mean fighting machine. It was so much fun to watch. There was literally a point where I crawled out of my seat and just kneeled on the ground for a second to take a breath. That didn't happen here.
Yeah.
All that stuff anyway. Like, yeah. Wasn't the whole point of the raid and what made it special was the fact that it was, like, the levels and the boss? Like, who really... story's great. I prefer all my movies with
And stories. I don't want to see just the raid again, but it's, like, it's just too much story. Like, I think this narrative could have worked, and they could have just kept it being, like, Rama having to fight people or, like, take people down who either know his secret or, like... for him to continue his whatever, that totally would have worked. That totally would have been interesting. But you have that, and you have Uko's story, and you have the story about the assassin with the family, and you have the story about Hammer Girl and her brother
Eka,
or something.
The other, Uko's, like, BFF, the other character.
Oh, right. There's, like, with the glove for no apparent reason. Right.
I think what you said is right. Like, I don't know. I feel like I'm being really hard on a movie that ultimately I had a pretty good time at, but... I think that what you said kind of hit it on the head, where someday someone's going to put together a supercut that's just all the fight scenes, and that's kind of what I want to see. Like, I don't want to spend an extra 50 minutes delving into the inner lives of, like, really boring, cliched gangster characters.
Well, we've seen how do the fight scenes even compare? Like, do they up it in this one?
Well, there's a lot more people in them. But
there's more people, and there's a little bit more variety because, as we said, like, you know, like, so Hammer Girl, her brother is this guy who...
Baseball Batman is how they're referring to him.
He literally carries around a bat and, like, a baseball and, like, literally, like...
Which is cool.
So, like, there's a big, like, epic prison yard fight scene, which is, like, really exciting. I think the action is more varied, and that makes it a little bit more fun, and that part makes it worthy of watching if you like The Raid 1. But, like we've been saying, I think pretty much everything that's not the fight scenes kind of falls apart, honestly.
Yeah, and I think the fight scenes they've become a little episodic, because it's just like, fight scene! And then it just feels like, plot.
And because there's so much plot and so many characters, it doesn't, like, The Raid 2, it was like, there were, like, you know, fight scene. It was episodic, but it was kind of knit together by this very tight narrative, whereas this one isn't, so you just kind of feel like you're watching disparate fight scenes that may as well be from different movies.
You're
like,
totally right.
The Hammer Girl fight scene could have been from a completely different movie, which I also would have watched.
Sure, and that's kind of the thing.
Really,
like, I wish it had
anything to do with anything else.
I wish that this had been three separate movies instead of one, you know, clusterfuck of a movie that's just... It feels like a smorgasbord. It literally just feels like he just threw a bunch of ideas to a wall to see what stuck, and I don't think a lot of it does. I think if you really like the first one and you can't wait for this to come out on DVD, then go ahead, but I don't think you're going to lose a lot if you just wait. And the advantage is, if you just wait, you can fast-forward through the boring plot stuff.
Yes, pretty much. I co-signed that... that opinion.
All right, so next up we've got Cheap Thrills, and in my opinion, it is a movie that takes every little bit of its running time, unlike The Raid 2, and uses it, like, to the max. I love every second of this movie. It honestly would have been in my top 10 of 2013 had it got a theatrical release in 2013. But anyway, this is a movie about a guy named Craig. He is a father and a husband and a loving one, a good one. But one day, not only does he get an eviction notice, but he also loses his job. So he goes to drink away his problems at the bar and happens to run into an old friend who's played by Ethan Embry, Vince. And the two of them are having a drink, and then they happen to bump into this other couple, this other crazy couple played by David Koechner and Sarah Paxton. And all of a sudden, one thing leads to another, and they start daring Ethan Embry and Pat Healy's characters to do things for money, you know, like hit that girl's ass for like $50, stuff like that. But it escalates, and shit just gets crazy. And I love this movie. I think Pat Healy is so underrated, and he really needs to be noticed. He takes his character on such an incredible arc in something that should have been a total shtick movie. This should have been just, you know, like Would You Rather, or another movie that just came out on VOD, 13 Sins. It's like the fun of imagining what you would do in that situation. But then on top of that, you get this really well-developed character, actually more than one of them. I would say Ethan Embry's character also has quite a few layers to him. And they're working in tandem the whole time, so not only are you having fun with this whole outrageous scenario, but you are truly invested in the characters also. This is a great movie. So far, so good for 2014. Obviously, it's only March, so I'm not going to say it's on my best of the list, best of the year list just yet, but it's there right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think you pointed to one of the things that really impressed me about it is that it's a really character-driven movie in, and I haven't seen very many movies that like this that felt really character-driven. You know, I consider it a horror movie. I guess you could argue that it's not really, but you know, most horror movies you watch, like, you know, a family moves into a haunted house and things happen to them and it doesn't really matter what kind of people they are. This one, every choice that they make is really informed by, like, you know, where they're coming from and their where they are in life and where they want to go in life. So that was really interesting. Although that's not really true of the two rich people, but David Koechner is so fun as, like, the rich asshole that I can't say I really minded.
Yeah, he made a lot of sense to me. I think, you know, I do agree. I think that Pat Healy is really great in this, and it gives him a lot more to do than the innkeepers gave him to do. There is an actually interesting arc, and you get to watch him really kind of devolve as a person because, you know, he desperately needs this money, and it becomes that thing of, like, what would you do to save your family from being homeless? And the answer is a lot. He would do a lot. And Ethan Embry, it's so fun because it's like, I mean, we grew up with Ethan Embry being, like, the goofy, like, cute kid in movies, and now he's, like, this weird, dirty man, and it was really fun to watch that. He was really great.
He's tough stuff, too. I did a whole interview with him, and the whole point of the interview was to talk about going from, you know, Empire Records and Can't Hardly Wait to being a total badass in Cheap Thrills, and, like, some of his other stuff, too.
I knew Ethan Embry was in this movie. I knew he was one of the main characters. It still took me like 30 minutes after he appeared to be like, oh my god, that's actually him. Like,
yeah.
Because at first I was like, is that? No.
I think David's great in it too because his whole shtick just works where he can play this asshole guy and it's really fun to watch. And like his whole thing is it's his girl's birthday. It's Sarah Paxton's birthday and he wants to give her a birthday she'll never forget. So it is this fucked up game. And I bought that. I bought that. All made sense to me. What doesn't work for me is Sarah Paxton's character. She is like, she's that fiction of like aloof and beautiful and fucked up and she wants to see crazy things, but she's barely gonna, like, she barely talks in this movie. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And like there's like moments where you think she's gonna like get some emotional depth and it's like, no, never mind. JK. JK. Instead she's gonna be in her underwear. It's fine.
I'll give you that. I mean, yeah, there's not all that much to her. Back at South by last year, I even, like, phrased a question like, you know, you do just stare at a cell phone for, like, 75% of this movie. How do you make a character out of that?
Yeah.
She got some good answers, though. So I think there was something to it where she did come up with a pretty reasonable backstory and all that. But as presented in this movie, you know, doesn't really do all that much. Yeah, if anything, she enhances David Koechner's character more than anything.
I guess. Yeah, she's more of like an appendage to his character than her own character. I thought that she was, you know, fun and interesting for what she is given, but she's not really given much.
I don't fault her, because I saw her in Innkeepers, and she's great in that. I think it's just really that that part is completely underwritten. That part is completely, you know, she's a symbol of, like, you know, the beautiful girl that guys want to impress. She
yeah, there's actually a scene, like, early on where Ethan Embry's, like, looking at her at the bar, and he's talking to Pat Healy's character, and he's like, oh, man, what would it take to keep a girl like that? So she's, as you said, she's more of a symbol or an object of desire than, like, an actual character in her own right. So one thing that was really amusing to me was that this movie reminded me in a lot of ways of Compliance, and then I realized that it's that Pat Healy is kind of like, he's the villain in that movie, you know, who's getting these people to do these awful things, and then in this movie, he's the one that is having, you know, that other people are getting to do awful things, and it felt to me like a kind of like karmic Hollywood justice. but it reminded me of that other movie, and I liked it for a similar reason, where it starts out with, like, you know, if someone just comes up to you and they ask you to do something horrible, like what they ask people to do in Compliance or what they ask people to do in Cheap Thrills, your first answer would be like, LOL, fuck no, fuck off. But the way that both these movies work is they kind of like gradually build up to it to a point where you really believe that this could happen. Also, the other thing that I loved about this movie is I saw it at home, and my fiance was sitting next to me for most of it, and it's just a really fun conversation piece because every time the characters would take on a dare for money, we'd be like, how much would you do that for?
Well, but really, what would you guys, where would you guys stop?
I forget the progression. Shot for $50, no problem. Smacking that girl's ass. That was like $100 to smack that girl's ass. To get slapped in the face. I would have done that.
Well, I think they paid him like $500 to punch this huge bouncer in the face.
I wouldn't have done that.
Would have
punched me in two. I am very small. That's. I wouldn't have done that. That I would have been broken in half. That wouldn't. There's some other stuff in here I wouldn't do.
But on the bright side, a bouncer probably wouldn't have punched a girl back.
That's probably true.
That's true. But I don't want to get too spoilery, so I won't say what are some of the other crazy things.
There's a sequence that they tease in the trailer, though, with the finger, and I think that's actually really interesting.
How awesome is the shot after that happens? I'm, like, fascinated by that shot, where it's, like, really just, like, letting him do his thing and then having the camera enhance that. That's what it is, and it's freaking beautiful.
It's really good.
And, you know, that's something we should touch on. This is a first feature. Which is just downright incredible to me. Because
that's true.
Every element of this is great, the story and the characters and the performances, but the directing is so on point. This guy knew what he wanted. He knew how to combine everything to make it happen and to get that tone that makes it work, and he did it. And it's awesome.
I should say, it is... Oh, sorry. Okay.
I hope that was an important call.
That's my husband saying he's on his way. That's embarrassing. It's a terrible ringtone. Everyone ignore it. Moving on. Anyway, no, but what I liked about it is that it is scary. I would definitely call this a horror movie because it's that brand of horror about how everybody can become a monster given the right encouragement. But it is really funny. It's just one of those things, like you said, it's fun to watch and just be like, oh god, like it does feel like watching like Wipeout or Jackass or something. And then you do ask yourself, like, would you cut off your own finger for $25,000? Just the pinky. Just, what are you even using that for? And it's like, you know, it's an interesting question. Especially, like, and then the prices just go higher and higher. Like, you might want to be like, no, I would never. But then, like, they set up the stakes for these characters so well that you can completely understand why they would take the risks they take.
Yeah, that was something Ethan Embry brought up in my interview, too, because we were discussing, you know, what would you do? And when I asked that to other actors, they're like, you know, I'm a chicken. I wouldn't do this. But when you consider what's on the line, like, really? I think I'd do just about anything in the world for my family. I'd, like, freaking cut off my whole arm, really.
Yeah. Yeah. To go way back, that was always my problem watching Saw. Like, I enjoyed Saw, but he spends that whole movie being like, I don't know, would I kill this stranger for my family? I was like, yeah, you killed the stranger for your family. Now, admittedly, like, I don't have kids and stuff, and I probably won't be put in that scenario, so hopefully whatever, but, like, I don't know. I spent a lot of time as a kid thinking of those rhetorical questions, so, like, that bothered me, where I was like, why is this taking you so long? I think that's why I like Cheap Thrills, because he just kept, really quickly, they had to make bonkers decisions and be like, yeah or no, and, like, I... And because of the competitive nature, because that's the thing, I don't know if we made that clear, If one of them doesn't take the dare, the other one can. So, you know, there's also that sense of the two of them wanting to be better than each other, too. On top of everything else, all these other things, there's a lot of motivations that drive the plot forward. And even though it's a really small story, and it's I think it only takes place in like two or three locations the whole movie, it's pretty tight. But they do a really great job of keeping it going forward and having it, you know, really thrust itself into something interesting. So I did overall like it. There's, you know, points off for the girl character just being the pretty girl character, but overall I do think it's fun.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned how high the stakes are for the characters, and I just want to bring up real quick that, you know, if you want to read this as like sort of a through like a socio-political lens of like rich people getting poor people to see what they'll do for scraps, that's also a way to read it. I mean, I don't think you have to read it that way. You could ignore all of the socio-political stuff and just enjoy it as like a funny, exciting thriller. But that was one thing about it that I thought was made it cut a little bit deeper than the average, you know, goofy horror movie.
Yeah, there's definitely a Dance Monkey Dance element to it.
Yeah.
Well, you could probably tell, but I can't recommend it enough. I think it's available on VOD and iTunes and all that. Go watch it. But also, it's an absolute blast to watch in the theater. I've seen it on my computer twice. I've seen it in the theater twice. And I mean, both each and every time, I have like a great experience watching it. I can't get enough of this movie.
One more thing. That final shot. You should watch it.
Oh, my God.
That final shot. Okay, that's all I'm going to say because I don't want to spoil it anyway. But
I'll give you that. All right. Next up, Noah. Angie, you're up.
Okay, so Noah is the new movie by Darren Aronofsky, and you probably already know what it's about because it's called Noah. It's the story of Noah's Ark. Russell Crowe plays Noah. You know, he gets a vision from God that he has to build the Ark and the animals and, you know, all that stuff, and all of that happens. It happens pretty much, you know, it's a story you know, but this being Darren Aronofsky, of course, it's not like some cute story about like this gentle old man with like these cute cartoon animals. Like it's a very dark story. You know, this is a Darren Aronofsky character, so he's a character that is driven to a really unhealthy point by his obsession with like God has asked me to do this and I have to do this. So, yeah, like, I think at first when I heard that Darren Aronofsky was doing Noah's movie, I was like, oh, okay. But then the more I thought about it, the more I was like, oh, yeah, that actually makes total sense for the kind of movies that he always makes. But one way that it's a little bit unusual for him is that it's, like, a big-budget studio movie. But I would say that it's still, I think a lot of people were kind of like, oh, you know, does that mean they're going to, like, sand on his rough edges or that he's, like, quote-unquote sold out? You know, I don't like that phrase, but you know what I mean. But when I watched it,
I was gonna go with no.
Huh? Yeah, no, it was still a very Aronofsky kind of movie, to the point where I can kind of see why there were rumors that Paramount was not thrilled with his take, and I can kind of see why, because it's very Aronofsky-esque. It's not as obtuse as, like, The Fountain, but, you know, it's not your straightforward, you know, action-adventure superhero.
Why hire him if you want that in the first place?
Right. That's true. I would definitely describe it as a bonkers movie. Because one thing, I don't think this is a huge spoiler because it's introduced pretty early on. One thing, I grew up going to Catholic school, so like the story of Noah is something I heard a lot growing up. Never heard about rock monsters.
They're the best part, seriously. If I learned about that when I was in Hebrew school, I'd be like, hell yeah, Noah.
Oh my God, it's been 2 days since I saw it, and I still can't decide if they were awesome or awful?
No, because I'm going to go with awful. The Watchers are the best part of this movie. I want everything else to go away, and I just want a Watchers feature.
No, okay, so the Watchers are these fallen angels that God punishes by turning them into, essentially, they look and move like Transformers. You know,
they even sound like Optimus Prime.
No, that's true.
And they're sort of like, at first they're like mad at Noah, but then one of them's like, no, he's cool. And then, so then the rest of them are all on board and they help him with this whole Ark thing. And like, I don't know. Then they kind of disappear once they go on the boat.
Rock like minions. I think that's why I like them.
I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, it was like kind of amusing, but on the other hand, I thought that tonally it was just so weird for the movie. It just, I mean, the fact that we're describing them as, like, being, like, minions in Transformers, I was like, what are you doing, this movie? This is
it
so
It didn't fit in the story at all.
It's weird.
You know, on the one hand, he's trying to make this a grounded human story, and then on the other, it's these, I guess,
Rock
I mean...
monsters.
I mean, the whole story, in a sense, is supernatural, but I mean, like, a cinematic sense of supernatural slash sci-fi, where it's just two polar opposites.
That's the weird thing for me, because the movie does get into, like, science fiction and fantasy, where, like, the fantasy element is obviously, like, there's miracles and all this kind of stuff, but then, like, they take a great deal of time to be like, oh, and then Noah's wife makes a special serum that puts the animals to sleep on the ark.
Now, everyone in this movie, though, falls to sleep in, like, the most peaceful way imaginable. Like, people get sung to sleep, the animals get, like, dusted or, like, you know, steam.
And it's like a magical...
You're right, there's so much sleeping in this movie.
I wish I could fall asleep every night like these characters.
I feel like you might be kind of tired right now, and that's why you're fixated on that point, but you're not just sleeping.
I thought about it quite a bit, because it happens, and every single time it happens, I'm like, yeah, sure, she's really going to fall asleep because you sing that stupid song.
Well, it's also weird because they introduce you with Methuselah, and he, like, touches the kid's head, and the kid conks out, and I was like, what is happening? Okay, whatever.
Which character was that? Was that Shem, the older son?
Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, he basically looks like he Vulcan grips the kid's face, and the kid falls asleep, but it looks
that
like...
That is what it is.
Right? But then it's like, whatever. I didn't like this movie. I'm just... One, I actually found it really boring. As action-packed as it is, which it is, like, action movie, because there's fighting, and there's threats of vengeance, and there's running through woods and rock monster battles, and, you know, whatever. There's a lot going on. I was really bored. And I think it's because Noah was so inflexible a character to me that I just was tired to death of him so early on, and then it was just like, the rest of the movie is just like me being like, why doesn't he listen to anybody else? Because it's not like God sends him visions. Oh, also, they never call him God. He's the creator, but they still decide he's male, because people keep going, he, fine. Anyway, but like, I have a whole issue with the gender politics of this movie, but we may not get into that, I don't know. But anyway, but like, he sees visions, that he understands a flood is coming, that he understands that he is tasked with saving the animals, fine. But God never speaks to him directly. So when other things happen that he doesn't expect, I found it really infuriating that he, like, decides somebody else is to blame and not that maybe you didn't understand what God's vision was for you. Why don't you settle down a second? Like, he's just always so certain of this narrow viewpoint of what he believes God is saying. And it's just, it's kind of gross. And like,
I hear what you're saying, but that was actually the part that was... Okay, so the first half of this movie is basically everything up to the flood. And then the second half of the movie is when they're actually in the ark during the flood, and then the stuff that happens after. And the movie to me was, you know, kind of tonally weird and uneven, but I was having a good time for the first half. And then the second half is when the human drama kicks in, and I think that's where a lot of stuff you mentioned, where Noah is a very inflexible character, and that comes into play and creates a lot of drama, because if you can just imagine being cooped up in a fucking ark with a super rigid Russell Crowe for, you know, 40 days and 40 nights, I guess, is in the book. You know, it's...
Well, we know it's longer because of a plot detail that we can't get into, because it goes into spoilers. But we know it's longer than 40 days and 40 nights.
Right. Anyway, but to me, that was really interesting because, I don't know, if he's not a likable character, but if you take for granted that he's the kind of person that's just so convinced that he's been chosen for this, that, you know, it's that this is really important and that, you know, he's the only person who can do this, it makes sense to me why he's in this horrible position.
I think the part, though, that's missing from that end is that I think because he's the main character all along, the audience needed to feel the fact that, you know, maybe that is what God's wish was, but maybe it wasn't. Like, if you were part of that battle in his head, it might have been more engaging. But, you know,
I don't think that it ever occurs to him that it isn't, because I think he's just, you know, misguidedly maybe, but he's very, very certain. And I think that, as an audience member in my head, I was, you know, like, you get so mad at him. That's the other thing about this movie that I thought was kind of amazing is, you know, earlier I said this isn't like the kind of cutesy Noah you learn in Sunday school. No, it is fucking dark. There is a scene where you see people just dying, you know.
It's really grim.
How really, really grim. Horrible. Like, I mean, I think we've all heard the tale 100 times, but it never occurred to me to wonder what happened to the people that didn't get to go on the Ark.
Well, it always bothered me as a kid because they would tell you, like, oh, everyone was evil except Noah's family. I'm like, everybody? And the thing is in this movie that still makes me mad is, no, not everybody, guys. Noah's just kind of a dick. Like, Noah's just super judgmental. Because, like, there's one scene, and I'm not going to get super into it, but there's one scene where he goes to a village to find sons or wives for his sons because he's got 3 boys, one, like, adopted daughter, so one is in theory taken care of, but he needs 2 girls so that, you know, humanity can continue. And he goes there, and he basically finds men trading women so that they can be raped, so the men can get, like, meat. Like, this is the, like, here's a 12-year-old girl, here's some meat, and they go away. And it's a horrible thing. It's just terrifying. And I thought, oh, okay, so Noah's going to go and save 2 of these poor girls. Nope, that's how it's going to happen, guys. It's okay. Don't think about that too long. It's just, he starts making these decisions of, like, well, humanity's damned anyway, and it's like I completely lost interest in him at that point and started rooting for, like, the other characters, not so much the doomed villagers, but, like, well, some of them. But, like, his sons, you know, who want to carry on life and who want to do something, and, like, Noah's so focused on, like, what he believes his mission is that it just got really infuriating to me, and then there's
but
a point.
I get what you're saying, but I feel like the movie never wants you to think the whole way through, oh, Noah's doing the right thing, he's a hero, because there's a, you know, like, about halfway through their trip on the boat or whatever, it becomes very clear that he has become sort of the villain, and the movie doesn't sugarcoat that at all. The movie's never like, oh, you know, but he was right to be a horrible person and do all these awful things. Like,
but I think it still respects him because it mirrors other Bible stories where, you know, the thing was that you do what God tells you to do, and because God is silent, his motivations are unclear, especially because for some reason, like, the other things that happen, if it's not Noah's vision, he does not believe it's God's will or God has anything to do with God, which doesn't make any damn sense to me. But then there's, like, a running thread where women get blamed for bringing down humanity, which is really confusing because everyone in the movie who has any power whatsoever is male. And, I mean, that's just, like, I get that that's, like, the Bible, and that tends to be how the Bible's written, but it's 2014. He threw in rock monsters, so it's frustrating to me that you have this infrastructure where it's effectively the patriarchy, where it's specifically white men who are in charge of everything. Noah's going to save the day. Methuselah fought this big battle before. The other guy in charge, the king of the earth or whatever, he's also a white guy. But every time they're like, you've ruined everything. It's Eve with the damn apple or in whatever. It's the women in the third act and them and their women ways. Ugh. And I got so, like, bored.
I think all of your points are totally just. But at the same time, I liked this movie a lot, but for all the wrong reasons. But really, that's what I appreciated. I appreciated these big, crazy moments that really made no sense at all. This was you know, a dramatic action movie for me. And I was thoroughly entertained from beginning to end, but sitting down and discussing it after, there are quite a few things that don't make any sense. And, you know, yeah, I mean, you said it best, Christy. Noah's a dick. I don't like him, and I certainly didn't like him at the end of the movie either.
Christy, like, you were going on about the, you know, the gender politics in this, but I think it's not a movie that is particularly kind to women, but I think it's a little bit more complicated. To me, the most interesting relationship he has with any of his children is his adopted daughter, who is played by Emma Watson.
She's awesome.
They go through a lot.
Yeah, she's very good. And I'm overstating a little bit because I can't really get into the plot details without massively spoiling it, because
right.
I know you're thinking, like, oh, it's the story of Noah, so we all know it. They're rock monsters, guys. It's a little different. But
a lot of things happen while they're on the Ark. Let's just put
it
that
exactly.
Way.
So that's really, I'm alluding to stuff that I can't really talk about. So
right.
my hands are kind of tied in explaining it. But I do have a question. Do you guys think, one, that it'll do well this weekend, and two, that the religious groups that have been so pumped to see this movie and who've already bought a bunch of tickets, do you think they're going to be pleased with what they see?
I think that it's going to do well-ish. I don't know what the budget was on this, but I have a feeling it'll probably make between 40 and 50 million, which is a pretty solid start. And I just think in terms of, like, whether people like it or not, this is going to be totally polarizing. Either you really dig it or you don't. There's going to be no middle ground.
I think it's probably going to do decently well financially. I think, you know, what Perry said lines up with most most of what I've heard. I think whether or not you like it as a religious person is really going to depend on how you like your religion. Like, if you are the kind of person that wants, you know, very straightforward, like, Bible hero stories, like, this is a good guy, you know, he's an awesome guy, he did all these great things, hooray for him, then you're not going to like it. If, on the other hand, you're someone that kind of likes to see, likes to connect to your heroes on a more human level, I think that it'll be more interesting because, you know, Noah, whether you like him or not, is very human and very flawed in this movie. He's not a perfect hero.
I think that's a very good point. Yeah.
All right. What do you guys think? Should people go see it or no?
I would not recommend people see this, but I was just not on board.
I think if you like Rick,
I wasn't on the arc. Sorry guys, it's late.
I'm a little slow.
I think if you like Darren Aronofsky's movies, you definitely should check out this one because it's very Darren Aronofsky, like I said. Otherwise, I honestly don't know. I mean, just for the reasons I've already said, I think that overall I liked it a lot and I would recommend it in general, but I can also see how it is not for everyone. I'll put it that way.
I think if you think the idea of Noah meets rock monsters is intriguing in the slightest bit, you will like this movie.
And if but
you
maybe only like, the first half.
If you think it's absolutely ridiculous, you might want to take a pass.
I want people to tweet at the Pope and see it, be like, Pope, did Russell Crowe tell you it has rock monsters? Because then maybe he would change around. Because Russell, I don't know if you guys knew, Russell Crowe has flat out tweeted at the Pope a bunch of times being like, how about you watch Noah?
Which that's is really classy.
That's my favorite thing about this movie. I'm actually really fascinated by that. I want to know what Russell Crowe... I mean, clearly he hoped for him to see the movie, but I want to know what he thought the Pope was going to... It's like... It's such a weird movie. Also, it is 2.5 hours long. The Pope, in theory, has, like, does he have time for that? I don't really know what the Pope does.
I bet that if the Pope was like, I want to watch this, they'd be like, we will send a screener. And
oh, no, Paramount was like, they would be super exactly. happy to do that,
so,
I'm sure.
You know, maybe the Pope does have time. Maybe he's like, you know what, I'm done with my work for the day, but man, I'm not really sleepy yet. I'll just call up Paramount, and then they'll be like, oh, my God, we'll have someone there in 2 seconds.
Right. They've got messengers in the Vatican just waiting. Be like, if the Pope calls.
Yeah, you know what? I think one of my favorite parts of the Noah experience has right now become imagining the Pope trying to watch Noah.
I hope Saturday Night Live does a sketch of that this weekend. I would that would be amazing.
I wouldn't be surprised if that happened. All right.
Anyway, so I guess that's about it for Noah.
Yeah, that's it for Noah, and that's also it for the show this week. But, of course, if you enjoyed, you can keep following along at popcornprosecco.com, on Twitter, at popcornprosecco, and subscribe to our YouTube channel, Popcorn Prosecco. And, of course, you can catch all three of us all over the web. Angie, where can viewers catch you?
You can find me on Twitter at AJ Han. That's AJHAN. Or you can look for my writing on slashfilm.com.
And Christy?
You can find me on Twitter, at Christy Puchko, KristyPuchko, for Cinema Blend, a bunch of other sites, so keep up with me there.
And I will just direct you to littlemisscritical.com, where you can catch all of my writing that's all over the place, and also on Twitter, my handle is pnemeroff. Thank you so much for watching, and we can't wait to see you next time.
Good night. Goodbye. Sorry, I don't know what time of day people are watching this.